Discourse Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen. I'm joined by our Chief Pandemic Officer, Andrew Riley.
We're running out of letters now, aren't we?
A little bit. Seriously, though, before we go any further, this is a pretty serious event going on, the coronavirus. Neither of us, as far as I know, are medical professionals or doctors or anything remotely approaching the sort.
I am not an epidemiologist.
Neither am I. I tend to deal with serious situations with humor, which makes it seem like I'm not taking it serious. Hopefully, I am not giving that impression here. It's just the way I deal with things. But this is, I think, by all accounts, a pretty serious situation, the coronavirus. I asked you when you came over, do you think this is the biggest event of our lifetimes since 9/11? And you answered almost immediately without hesitation, which is kind of the same thing. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very big deal because the impact that it's having on our lives is on par with those kinds of life-changing moments. You know, people remember the events of September 11th that they were alive to. We have listeners who may not be old enough to remember that because that was now coming up on 20 years ago. Because we're old, but we remember it. And you can go back further. I remember situations about the Berlin Wall falling. I remember the Challenger explosion. We've talked about that on other episodes. This is one of those.
Boomer.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where we are going to certainly know how it affects us for much longer than it actually does affect us. But the impacts will be significant, and they will be wider spread than the September 11th impacts. The September 11th impacts, you know, the death toll was all things quite small. But how it affected us was much larger. This one, the death toll, I suspect, will end up being larger than September 11th, almost certainly. And I suspect it's going to be much wider in its effect. There are going to be more people who know someone who is affected by this.
It's so hard to compare, though, because you say the death toll for 9/11, but do you count the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, extremely long-lasting wars that are almost a direct result of 9/11? But it's at the same time, it's kind of unfair to add that to the death toll because they were...
But the thing is, you're 100% right. It is unfair to sort of say that, but I would say that I would ultimately agree. The death toll from the actual September 11th attacks, roughly 4,000. Our death toll from the wars in Iraq, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm going to say, all told, war deaths in Iraq have been substantially under 100,000. I would not be surprised if they were much, much lower than that. I don't know. I do think the death toll from coronavirus will probably top 100,000. So even counting the war deaths, American citizens, soldiers, ours, we've killed plenty more of other countries. But I think that our U.S. deaths will be higher from this than even those knock-on effects that you're talking about.
Yeah, and like you alluded to, that's just referring to U.S. deaths and not even touching upon Iraqi citizens and civilians who may have died indirectly from the destabilization of the government or whatever else going on in that area.
And meanwhile, this disease is global. It's not just, okay, it's in Iraq, it's in Afghanistan. No, it's in China. Mm-hmm. And China has had its numbers stall, at least their official numbers, a number of cases at something like 80,000 cases with something like 3,000 or 4,000 deaths. But those numbers are suspiciously stalled, shall we say. I think that there are probably a lot more cases that we're not hearing about.
Perhaps, but at the same time, an authoritarian regime like China does have certain abilities to take drastic measures that could prove helpful in a situation like this.
Yes, they wield more force, more power, and the people are more willing to accede to that power. So if they say quarantine, complete lockdown of this zone, people will obey it more than they would in, say, Italy, which is trying to do a full country lockdown and not having as much success because they're used to a higher level of freedom. And even then, even Italy is having those kinds of complete lockdowns. People, even just a complete lockdown, you know, the reason is the coronavirus, this COVID-19, but that kind of thing will have an impact psychologically on the people, and this is one of those things that is going to be generational defining.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're not on the Twitters, but I've seen a number of people who have said, you know, oh, the Democrats are saying we should not go out to public gatherings or whatever. Well, I'm going to Red Robin tonight, and I'm going to take my time savoring my dinner amongst all my fellow Americans because we're not going to bow to the to stupid coronavirus or whatever.
Is there a reason why you picked Red Robin?
That is actually a specific example. I saw Red Robin was a hashtag that was trending, and I'm like, why is Red Robin trending? Well, because apparently a politician had, in order to own the libs, quote unquote, had decided that they were going to go out to Red Robin and enjoy a meal amongst their fellow Americans. So, to your point, like, Americans are accustomed to a certain level of freedom and are prone to giving the middle finger to the government whenever the government tells them to do something.
Especially Americans of a certain political bent, us.
And especially, you know, especially with the government that we have in place right now, which has been mishandling the situation, possibly, and which half of the country is probably predisposed to hating anyway. It's probably not an ideal situation. But before we go any further, I think you wanted to ask me some sort of over-under.
Right.
You've already given away a little bit of your thought process.
Right.
But why don't you go ahead?
So we were having this conversation before this podcast while we were prepping for some other things. And
the Democratic debate.
We were watching the Democratic debate, and they were talking a lot about coronavirus in the Democratic debate. And something that was mentioned caused me to ask you about the severity of it, whether or not you thought this would be, you know, in terms of death tolls, which is one of the things that people are most concerned about here, what the likely death toll is going to be. Is this going to be, you know, overall not that big of a deal, even though it impacts our lives significantly? How many deaths are there going to be? And I asked you for an over-under. And I asked you to basically come up with a number, and you peg it, and I'll go over or under, and we'll see, you know, where we're feeling about it as a result of that.
Yeah, and so to be clear, and to repeat myself from earlier, not at all a doctor. Have no qualifications at all.
This is random, wild-ass guessing from educated people who have been paying close attention to the situation, mm-hmm. but definitely not experts. We have no inside knowledge. This is gut feelings of man on the street kind of thing.
And even the experts, I think, would admit, like, they have no idea.
There is a huge range for this to be in.
Yeah.
And so my guesses are based entirely on, okay, well, it's within this range to this range, and therefore it should be something like this.
And you see, well, I have seen examples of how, again, with the Twitters, there was another hashtag trending, don't be patient 31. And it referred to, I believe in South Korea, they had 30 patients that had coronavirus, and they were keeping it relatively self-contained. And there was patient 31 who had caught coronavirus somehow and basically ignored all the suggestions to not go and went to church, went to the grocery store, all sorts of other places, and basically ended up causing their own little mini outbreak, which caused however many hundreds or thousands more cases. And so when you have a situation like that where a single person can cause so much damage, it's basically impossible to predict where things are going to go. All that being said, the number I'm going to pick for we'll say within a year, number of fatalities from COVID-19.
So year from current, because we've already had fatalities in the United States.
Year, so
but essentially
how about right total now. Number of deaths by March 15th of 2021?
Okay.
Not that we're going to come back and check on this, but
no.
I'm going to set the over under at 200,000.
I think that's a very solid over-under. I'm going to have a hard time thinking about where I'm going to go on that one.
And to be clear, that's a pretty horrifying number.
That's a terrible number.
Because you look at a lot of people were saying that, you know, the flu, this is just a bad flu or whatever. The flu doesn't typically kill that many people.
Let me run a couple of back-of-the-envelope number conversions on my piece of paper here in just a second. But
this will be fascinating audio.
Yeah, so let me talk for a second, and then I'll give you something to talk about.
Sure.
Let's talk about some definitions real quick. When it comes to coronavirus, the things we're interested in to know how bad this is going to be are infectivity and lethality. Infectivity is going to be most commonly categorized as R0. So the definition of R0 in epidemiology is the number of additional patients infected by the average person who has the disease. Or if they're a carrier, they infect people. If they have the disease and they have symptoms, they infect this many people. R0 is very important for determining how widespread the disease is going to be. And the estimates for R0 for this disease are something like 2 to 3, which seems like it might be pretty reasonable, but it means that it's spreading and it spreads quickly. That's actually pretty infectious.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is think of one person can infect 2 to 3, and then those 2 to 3 infect 2 to 3 more, and you play that out over a couple of generations, if you will, and you get a pretty big number.
Generations of the virus, not generations of humans.
Right, yes.
So with an infectivity rate of something as high as that, and this is one of those things where the infectivity rate is probably the biggest variable in this entire equation. We don't know because we can't do enough testing on it because it's the person who is sick. Do they have the coronavirus, COVID-19, or do they have something else that's similar? Is it flu season? Do they have a common cold? Is this just hypochondria panic coming in? Or do they even get tested in the first place? Do we have enough testing kits in the United States because of governmental response and other factors? We are not testing nearly enough people to really have a good grasp on the infectivity rate. South Korea has probably the best guess as to what the infection rate is going on because they've done a great job of testing. They also have, as a result, the lowest reported fatality rate. The lethality rate in South Korea is incredibly low because they have a lot more confirmed cases and relatively few deaths. So the second part is, once you know how many people have the disease, how lethal is it? How many people who have the disease end up dying as a result of the disease?
Yeah, and so I just want to interject quickly here. It's important to note, for those who haven't been following, that and I apologize if I'm making a stupid statement here, but I feel like it's worth reinforcing. The fatality rate is, there's two key numbers, right? The number of people who died and the number of people that you know who had the virus, a numerator, denominator.
Correct.
And so in order to get a accurate value to that fatality rate, you need to have a pretty good sense of both of those numbers. And obviously, it's a little easier to figure out the number of people who died from it, but it's a lot harder to figure out the number of people who have it because many may not have the symptoms, or they may have the symptoms and think it's just a bad cold and may not come in to get tested, or they may have the symptoms, think they have coronavirus, come in to get tested, and they don't get tested, as is the case possibly in the United States right now, where we are not testing at perhaps not testing at the level that we should be. And so, to your point, South Korea seems to be testing at a very high level. We can trust their denominator and probably trust their numerator, so they have a pretty good sense of what the fatality rate is. It's a little harder for the United States, where it's hard to trust that denominator because we have no clue how many people might have the coronavirus, not be getting tested for whatever reason, or might be coming in to get tested and are getting denied tests, or whatever is going on. And so it's a little hard to look at the U.S. fatality rate and take anything away from that.
With the caveats on the timeline, because one of the most important things that we're seeing in the response to this coronavirus is that we are going down paths of mitigating the effectiveness of the disease and spreading. Flattening the curve, precisely. The terminology here, flattening the curve, meaning that this is following a bell curve. Their infection rate increases, and then decreases because you've reached the maximum infectious point for it and there's not enough new subjects to be reached. If you can reduce the level of contact from those high-frequency contact persons, the high-infectious rates persons, the ones that are traveling between communities, then you can slow the disease progress down. You don't stop it, but if you slow the disease progress down, you save lives for two reasons. One, maybe you decrease the overall number of contaminations slightly. You know, I'd say a ideal situation of flattening the curve, you reduce the number of cases by maybe 20%. So it's not really about reducing the cases. It's about lengthening the amount of time that this goes on. And why that is important is that by lengthening the amount of time this goes on, you decrease the stress that this puts on to the rest of the system in terms of healthcare. If this is a system, if this disease requires the high-risk patient to be put on a ventilator, you only have so many ventilators. If you can say, okay, we put this patient on a ventilator and we get them cured before the next patient comes in, then we're in much better shape in dealing with this and making sure a higher number of people survive. So the death rate, the fatality rate, the lethality goes down.
And at this point, I think it's important to point out that from all indications, there is a very strong connection between the age of an individual and the lethality of the virus.
Absolutely.
As far as we can tell, and again, with all the caveats that we don't know what's going on any more than anybody else, really. But as far as most of the CDC and the authorities seem to be able to tell, children are less susceptible to the virus in terms of how it affects them and how lethal it is. They can still spread it, probably as well as anybody else. Maybe, I don't know. I'm kind of speculating there. But the elderly, the people who are 50, 60, 70 plus years old, seem to be far more susceptible to having serious complications from this virus and likely to die from the virus. And so even if it's even more important to not spread the disease to nursing homes, to your grandparents, your great grandparents, or if you're our age, even your parents.
Yeah, my parents are late 60s or in their 70s. So
yeah, I mean, my mother's birthday was just 2 days ago, and they came over and we took them out to lunch for her birthday, and I gave it a second and third thought, and I certainly emailed them and said, "Do you still want to go out? ? Or is this a chance you want to take?" And we ended up going out, and I'm seeing a lot of feedback. Like, a lot of people have some strong feelings about that kind of thing.
I can see a lot of strong feelings coming in this, because something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, I think, is how this affects us psychologically and how this affects us economically. Mm-hmm. When we collectively, as individuals, make these decisions to go to the lunch out with our friends and families, or not to, because of concerns over the virus, because concerns of infection, because concerns of death, then that has a tremendous impact on the economy. So right now, Red Robin is getting a lot of people coming in saying, "Yeah, I want your Republican burger," or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that is probably a very short-term lived thing. Long-term, the longer this goes on, the more it's going to very negatively impact hospitality, restaurateurs, holidays, vacations, tourism. Anything that is an industry like that gets hit really hard, really fast. Airlines are seeing significant downturns in revenues, and all of these things have initial effects on the economy, and then there are the knock-on effects on the economy, where things that we don't even realize start to have second-level impacts on how we're producing things. You know, we were talking earlier, your job is saying telework. Okay, you're going to telework. You're probably not going to be that much less efficient, but one of the reasons why we don't all telework all the time is because it is less efficient.
And my kids are going to be at home, and I don't think they're going to be distracting me that much, but on Friday, I was home, and they certainly came in and distracted me a non-zero amount of time. Mm-hmm. And as far as I can tell, that my kids are going to be home for quite a long time.
Yeah.
As far as we can tell. We're in Virginia to
remind everyone. Set. So we've already been told that our children will not be going back to school until at least the end of the month, and in many cases, longer.
What do you think would be a Republican burger? I imagine it's like medium well, maybe medium. Definitely bacon. I don't think onions. Onions seem
bacon's
like
turned left a, thing. Bacon's definitely turned itself into a Republican thing. I'd say medium rare, even medium pure rare.
Wow, because, for a burger, for ground beef.
Yeah, because they're like, screw your rules and regulations. Yeah, I want fair. What I want.
Okay. The Democratic burger would definitely be like a Beyond Meat or an Impossible Burger.
Yes.
Some sort of veggie burger.
Veggie right? burger with yeah. extra veggies, like the, extra like the veggies. Onions.
I don't think it has cheese.
I think cheese is optional.
I don't know. Cheese isn't vegan. I'm thinking it's a vegan burger.
Well, I mean, how far in each direction we're talking as well, because this is on a scale.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. But you were talking about the economic effects, and
so before we go back to the economics, let me give you an answer. I've done the back of the envelope calculus, right. And on your underover, 200,000 deaths in the U.S. from COVID-19 by March 15th, 2021. I say over.
You say over. All right. But a lot over?
My numbers end up being a lot over. I'm really hoping these numbers are wrong.
Is it over 1 million?
Yeah.
Because when I first did the, like, oh, if I take the lower end of people who are going to catch it and say like 3% death rate, it was like 1.6 million or something like that. So, well, I can't be right.
I think it's less than 1.6. I really do. As I say these things, I don't want to be fear-mongering. These numbers are terrifying. Mm-hmm. And so people are going to hear me saying, oh my gosh, he thinks that over 1 million people are going to die. This is really bad. Yeah, it's really bad. Mm-hmm. But I've been saying as long as I've been knowing about this, I've been paying close attention to COVID for much longer than most people, I would say. And my number one response has been consistently, don't panic. If you're relatively young, relatively healthy, you don't have anything to worry about. Even if you catch COVID, which is seeming like it's more and more likely at this point, you're going to have bad symptoms, bad flu. You're going to have a bad time. But unless you are elderly or have underlying health conditions, your rates of fatality are incredibly low.
Yeah, it's something that I've struggled with because on one hand, calling this a bad flu doesn't seem all that far off base. To your point, if you're not elderly and have no pre-existing medical conditions, you don't have a lot to worry about. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like. And again, all the qualifiers from the beginning of the podcast, we're not medical professionals at all, but it seems like your chances of dying from this aren't that much worse than the flu if you're not elderly or have pre-existing respiratory problems or whatever. But at the same time, it seems like the best way to avoid hundreds of thousands or millions of the more susceptible people in our country and all around the world from dying is to basically overreact.
Absolutely.
And to shut everything down. And so it's kind of a catch-22 almost.
It is.
Where like if we quote unquote overreact and this turns out to be a nothing burger, that's great. We did the right thing. Even though it would seem like we just overreacted to something that was just quote unquote a bad flu. And that's something I struggle with all the time because it both those can be right at the same time.
Right. And I think they actually are both right at the same time in this situation. This is a really scary, very dangerous situation that we want to be substantially less scary. This is the insurance problem all over again. The insurance problem is, I want to be protected if something goes wrong, but I don't want anything to go wrong, so I'm going to try and pretend that it won't go wrong and that I don't get insurance. This can't happen to me thinking about only the good things kind of problems.
Mm-hmm.
The insurance play here is flatten that curve. Avoid contact, wash your hands, do all the things that you need to be doing and should be doing, and then hope for the best. And if it is the best, then maybe only 10,000 or 60,000 people die, something more like a normal flu season. And that's still really bad. You know, 10,000 people dying is really bad, but that's normal.
And let's do our PSA here for the people who are living under a rock or maybe have better things to do. The best thing for pretty much everyone to do right now is to wash your hands. That's the best thing.
Step one.
If you cannot wash your hands, if you're out and about or whatever, use hand sanitizer.
At least 60% alcohol.
Try not to touch your face.
That's, again, goes hand in hand, but without being at all hand in hand. Don't touch your hands. Don't touch other people's hands, and don't let your hands touch your face.
And largely avoid large crowds of people who might give it to you or who you might give it to them.
And if you have any symptoms, if you have a cough or anything, consider taking additional steps, such as completely staying home, or if you need to go out, wearing a mask. One of the things that is very common in Asian cultures is that if you're sick, you wear a mask. The mask is not to help you not get sick. The mask is to help other people not get sick from you.
Because the virus will go through the mask.
Absolutely.
The mask is to prevent you from spewing saliva, mucus, whatever other transmission vehicles on other people.
Correct.
Except, I want to not necessarily correct you, but just clarify something you said. As far as I've heard, even people who are non-symptomatic can spread the disease. In fact, it's possible that the people who are showing no symptoms are even more likely to spread the disease.
That's one of those things that's unknown right now. We do know that there are diseases where non-symptomatic people are carriers and will transmit the disease. We know that that is likely to be the case here with children, because children tend to be asymptomatic with this because they are exposed to other coronaviruses so much more consistently than adults are.
So just because you think that, oh, I don't have a cough, I don't have a fever, I feel fine, don't think that it means that you are not carrying anything, because you might be. And we're not saying you are, obviously, but you still might be. So maybe don't go to the nursing home and shake everyone's hand there.
Right. Take reasonable precautions, especially when you're putting yourself into contact with those who are higher risk. When I visited my parents yesterday, I didn't make contact with them at all. I said hi from a distance, no hugs, no handshakes, and that's, you know, my family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's showing you that I'm taking this seriously.
And you hear about people who are going to nursing homes and yelling at their relatives through the windows. because they're like, I'm not going to go in there and take a chance of giving anybody anything.
Or in other cases, because they're required to, because the nursing homes have, as a precautionary thing, shut themselves down from outside contact.
Mm.
And this is, that's one of those things where these are the psychological effects. If you cannot have contact with your relatives, your loved ones, except in these remote ways, these non-touching ways, these non-human ways almost, it's not to say that we don't have human connection elsewhere, but we crave contact, close contact with our friends and loved ones. It's a human thing. We're introverts. We don't crave it as much. But there are people out there who really will feel psychologically put upon if they do not get these things. We are, you know, I've seen plenty of these jokes running around the internet recently where the introverts, introverts and the generational X's, we've prepared ourselves for this our entire lives. We're ready for the social distancing. Mm-hmm. We're comfortable with this. Mm-hmm. Of course we are. We happen to be next to each other doing this podcast, but we didn't have to be. And we would have been perfectly fine if we hadn't seen each other until the next podcast recording, because that's just how our relationship is. Most people aren't like us.
So to recap, wash your hands. If you can't, use hand sanitizer. Avoid unnecessary human contact for a longer time than you might think. It's surprising to me, but we're hearing a lot of, not just weeks, but maybe months, that we need to be taking these precautions in order to flatten the curve.
So the longer the curve is flattened, the longer that the disease is running around in parts of our society. The parts are maybe smaller, you know, but it means that this thing goes on for months and months. So 8 to 12 months is not at all unreasonable for this to be going on, that we'll still be thinking about coronavirus March of next year. We'll see this ebb and flow as well. There'll be periods where it's hot and periods where it's cold. Viruses, especially flu-like viruses, tend to fade in the summer. That's because of biological reasons, because of physical reasons, it's because of cultural reasons. But ultimately, whatever is slowing it down in the summer will fade, and it'll come back in the fall, most likely. If it's still around, especially if we've had success with lengthening the curve, we can expect a resurgence in the fall, that this will not go away, but yet come back. And my greatest concern, something that would potentially blow my worst-case numbers out of the water, is if it comes back with a mutation.
Mm.
If it's been mutated in a negative way that affects us more, and we see a resurgence in the fall, that would be the true worst-case scenario. So we hope that that's not going to be the case. We hope that we do everything we can to contain it now.
So from an introvert, probably the best thing to do is self-quarantine, break out a copy of Pandemic, maybe the legacy version, Pandemic Season 1 or Season 2. I'm actually looking at framed copies of our boards from Pandemic Season 1 and Season 2, and just play it with your spouse, children, whoever you live with that you can't get away from, and batten down the hatches for a fairly long time.
And as you do these things, we are going to see very negative impacts on the economy. We started to allude to those earlier.
Yeah.
It's probably worth spending a little bit of time identifying what that's going to look like.
If you haven't looked at your 401k recently,
don't.
Do me a favor and don't look at it for another 6, 12, 18 months. Because you're probably only going to make a bad decision based on that.
It is going to hurt. I did look at mine, and I had lost... I find it useful to talk about percentages of salary rather than raw numbers, because that is something that's transferable from person to person. I lost somewhere between a quarter and a third of an annual salary.
Oh, I think I have you beat there.
I'm sure you do.
I'm trying to do the math right now. And it's tough. So I would say midway through February, it's funny. The peak of the market was almost exactly on my birthday, February 21st. And so it's easy to remember. Right around February 21st, I remember thinking like, wow, I am crushing the market. For all those who are not aware, paulversusthemarket.com. I have my own little website where I try and beat the market by buying and selling individual stocks. And I was having a great year, an absolutely great year. I was crushing the market. And since that point, I'm going to say definitely over 50% of a year's salary I've lost in terms of investments. probably closer to 60-70%.
Yeah, you're much more heavily invested than I am.
And, you know, that could be for any reason, but it's been a huge percentage loss. I'm still beating the market, so yay. Thanks Tesla and Teladoc. Those have been two rock stars this year. But, yeah, it's painful. I've downed tens of thousands of dollars to put an absolute number on it. And back to where I was, you know, over a year ago. And then some, you know, definitely 20, 30, 40% down in a lot of names. And, yeah.
So I said it was over 200,000, and you asked me if it was my back of the envelope calculation was over 1 million. And I said, yes. And I very much hope that I'm wrong, but let's talk about the economic impact of 1 million deaths. If 1 million people, especially 1 million older people who may or may not have wealth built up over generations because of various categories that they may be in. If 1 million people like that die, how does that impact the economy?
At the risk of sounding callous...
Well, we have to a certain extent.
I don't think the deaths are going to affect the economy nearly as much as the steps being taken to prevent those deaths. Because... you're looking at large, huge population centers in the United States. Seattle, New York City, pretty much the entire country is considering just shutting everything down. Like, basically, don't go out and do anything except for buy food and other necessities.
Somebody still has to produce that food and that necessity.
And like we spoke to before, it may seem like an overreaction, and in some ways it is an overreaction, but it's still the appropriate response.
We hope it's an overreaction.
Yes. And so, assuming that it is an overreaction, then all that lost productivity, all those flights not taken, those cruises not taken, those everything not done, is going to crush the economy. Whereas... sure, deaths aren't good either, but I think it's going to be a rough couple of months for the economy, regardless of what happens. I mean, if people...
We're past the breaking point on that. It's already going to be bad.
Well, I mean, it's not showing up in earnings reports yet because it's just happened the past month, but you look at the market generally tends to be forward-looking. And the market knows what's going to happen. Almost every industry. And on top of this, we haven't even mentioned, Russia and Saudi Arabia are having a nice little...
an oil feud.
A feud about, let's see who can pump out more oil. Which, you know, normally if I had told you, like a month or I guess a month and a half, whatever, ago that, hey, oil prices are going to plummet and you're going to be able to refinance at like a rock bottom rate, you'd probably be all over that. Oh, and by the way, the stock market's going to be dropping by 30% or whatever it is. And
when oil prices go down, the stock market's going to crash with it to a certain extent simply because of...
a lot of oil companies.
Well, not just a lot of oil companies, but most of the time, oil being cheap means good things. It means that you can transport things cheaper, and a lot of companies are doing transport. It means you can buy your gasoline cheaper. But for companies, it's all about transporting their goods from place to place. That means cheaper prices. But yes, oil companies going down, you know, they're just not profitable. You know, there's the breaking point where these U.S. fracking companies need at least $50 a barrel for oil to be profitable. And if it's 51, 52, their investors are getting really nervous and going to sell. If it's under, then those companies are, as long as it's going under, they're losing money.
And it's supply and demand. There's two reasons oil prices can go down. One is that there's a lot more supply, which is the case happening here. But it also could be that demand is going down, which I think it's also fair to say. You look at all the grounded flights from airlines. There's not nearly as many flights going around the country. And
Or across the world.
Or across the world, yeah.
Yeah, the airline industry, I was hearing that some executives in the airline industry were talking about this being worse than 9/11 in terms of their global business plans, and that it would not, just some back, they were running some calculations and they were expecting 37% downturns in their their flights and their revenues. Therefore,
I'm actually surprised it's not higher, to be honest. Like
maybe that's him not speaking optimistically. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, it seems like the entire economy is going to grind to a halt, and not just for a couple weeks. Like just tonight, I think we saw that the CDC was recommending 8 weeks or something, that people avoid gatherings of 50 more people. That's a flight right there. 50 more people. That means don't get on a flight. Don't get on a cruise ship. Don't go to a movie theater. Don't go to a restaurant. Don't do anything, basically.
Right.
And
so, yeah.
That's tough.
Comes back around to your point that these preventative measures are going to have extreme effects on the economy.
And we've seen that already with the market essentially tanking. We've had the sharpest drop in a week in history, sharpest drop in a day since like 1987 or something along those lines.
We actually beat some 1987 days, and we had the biggest days, the top 10 days, a couple from 1987 to Black Monday and another Monday that followed right after. Some years in 1929, you might remember that year as the year of the...
I actually don't. I'm not that old, but I know you are because you love old things, but I'm not.
And then a couple of years from 1933, another really bad year.
Yeah.
This is unprecedentedly bad in modern history.
Yeah.
And it's probably not going to get better anytime soon. The market is forward-looking, so most of this is probably going to shake out of the market pretty quick. We're going to hit a bottom, not now. We're probably still going down, I would say, but this is, again, speculation. This is not investment advice. Do not try and time the market. You will fail. I expect we will continue to go down for maybe another month, and then we're going to bump along the bottom for months before we start trending back up, I'd say.
Very much in line with what you were saying. For those who aren't aware, my investing style is one that says that I have a 5+, 10+, 20+ year investing horizon. I'm not planning on retiring for quite some time. I do not try and maybe some people can time the market. I'm willing to grant that maybe some people have that skill. I do not. I have no ability to call any bottoms, no ability to call any tops. I don't know when things are going to go down. This could go down for quite some time more. But having said all that, I remain fully invested. I haven't sold a single stock. I sold one stock, and I immediately use those proceeds to buy something else. I'm 100% invested. I haven't pulled any money out of the market. I have increased my 401k contribution slightly, not because I'm trying to time the market at all. Like I said, it could go down for another 1, 2, 3, 4 months. It could go down for another 1, 2, 3, 4 years. My completely random speculation is that this is largely due to the coronavirus. This is not some sort of fundamental, like the Great Recession, collapse of some sort of housing bubble that needs to be worked out through the system. Once this coronavirus passes, the underlying economy seemed to be relatively healthy. And to your point, I'm thinking the recovery might be sooner rather than later. But again, that's not to say that the market can't go down another 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% over the coming 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks.
The market could go down longer. 6% tomorrow.
Exactly. In fact, the headlines seem to indicate that it might. As we speak, it looks like the circuit breakers have been tripped again. And so I am fully prepared for my investments to drop another 10, 20, 30%. And I will... I was investing through the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, 2009. The entire time, I was taking all the money I could find and dumping it into stocks. And I made some bad decisions. I'm not saying I was some sort of genius. But I think that for people who have a long-term investing horizon, if you're not going to retire in the next 1, 2, 3 years, you should be loving this pullback and putting as much money as possible into the market, because it's going to go up eventually. Maybe not in a year, maybe not in 2 years, maybe not even in 3 years. But by the time you retire, I think you're going to be happy.
Let me throw a caveat on that one. Because sure. I agree with you. But let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Because there are certainly circumstances where it doesn't go back up.
Sure. Look at Japan.
That's exactly what I was going to point to.
Yeah. There's definitely, and I've thought about this a long time, like, there's definitely a school of thought that maybe the United States is the exception rather than the rule, if you say, if you want to put it like that. Maybe the market won't always go up. and let me, I guess I should pull back a little bit and say, what is it? In the 1990s, right, is when Japan had... So
yeah, call it 1990 just to start, because close enough.
I'm bad with dates, but basically Japan had a roaring economy, doing great.
The 1980s were all about Japan. Japanese investors were buying real estate in New York City, and the news, if you were reading any of the news at that time, was how Japan's economy was going to take over the world, and Japan was the China of that era, where they were going to upset the United States and be the number one economy. And United States would be number two at that point.
Exactly. Everyone was freaking out. I'm like, oh my God, the Japanese, what can we learn from them and learn their ways? And then it all collapsed, and the Japanese stock market nosedived, and to a point where I believe it may have just recently returned to the levels it was before.
I think it took 20 years.
Something along 20 years.
They called it the lost decade, but it was really the lost 20 years.
And so in a lot of... For the United States, a lot of the idea of the stock market being one of the greatest wealth generators is that if you look at any 20-year period, there's never any time period, whether it's the Great Depression, the Great Recession, the dot-com bubble bursting, any of those things, there's never been a 20-year period where you've lost money in the stock market.
You just have to have a long enough time horizon.
Exactly.
That was not the case in Japan.
And there's no... There's no reason to think that it couldn't happen here.
Anything is possible.
It's one of those great... I hesitate to use Catch-22 twice in the same podcast, but, you know, past performance is not indicative of future results. And for the U.S., the stock market over 20 years has always gone up. But that could and probably has to end at some point. And... I guess my counter to that would be, I don't see any underlying reasons to think that would be the case. We still seem to be the most dynamic economy. The economy is still growing. Population growth may be a little bit of a concern, but probably not an immediate concern.
Yeah, I would say that if you're going to look at the reasons why we could be the next Japan, in the sense of that 20-year, 10-year time horizon no longer looking so good, that the things we've just been talking about of don't panic, buy and hold, wait it out, it'll come back, could be wrong. So if you're looking for the negative, is demographic issues.
Mm-hmm. And Japan, to be clear, Japan had much clearer demographic issues than the United States. Japan at the time had much clearer demographic issues than the United States now.
Right. With hindsight, we can look at it and say, okay, that was obvious, that we should have seen that coming, that the population was getting older, the younger population was not following through, there wasn't enough younger population to support the older population. The economy of Japan was particular in that they were reinvesting internally rather than looking outside of their borders, even though they were buying all that property in the United States, etc. There were structural issues that were, again, obvious in hindsight.
And perhaps I should take a step back, because we have received some feedback from some people about how sometimes we take for granted certain points. Like, I'll make a point, and you'll just, of course you're right, because we agree on so much stuff, and we never take the time to explain why we say these things. The argument is that Japan had what is called an aging population, and that they were not... on average, reproducing at a rate to replace their population. So if you picture
it's a population tree.
If you picture a bell curve, maybe, of their population, it kept on shifting to the right, to the older population, because there were fewer young people and more older people. And that's generally considered to be not very healthy for an economy, because you have less workers supporting more people and it's generally not considered to be that healthy. And Japan had a particularly bad aging population in that they were not reproducing at a rate to replace the population. I'm a little unclear as to the exact numbers. I'm not sure the United States is much better, but I think where we have an advantage is that we've traditionally had immigration
Yes.
to help offset our poor replacement reproduction
numbers. The United States reproduction rates and replacement rates have been much better.
Yeah, and even than Europe. Japan has traditionally been, I don't know if hostile to immigrants is the right word, but perhaps not as welcoming very to immigrants so. As the United States. And perhaps that is changing. I have read some articles indicating that immigration to the United States, the patterns have changed over the past couple of years for whatever reason. Maybe it's because, well, I'll just leave it at that, for whatever reason. So it's entirely possible that aging could come into play sooner rather than later. Having said all that, I still think that if you look at some of the largest, most innovative, most dynamic companies, you're still more likely to find them in the United States than anywhere else. And so there could be a time, 10, 20, 30 years from now, where that may not be the case. But for now, I'm still pretty confident in the United States economy.
Let me take one more demographic question.
Sure.
And that is pointing back to the question I asked earlier of the economic impact of the deaths.
Mm-hmm.
When we know that the majority of the deaths are coming from that high-end portion of the tree, the older population.
Mm-hmm.
The United States has a population replacement rate that is still better than, definitely Japan still, better than Europe, but has been trending down for 20 years. And so we've been getting older too, not nearly as dramatically as those other countries have, but with some significance. One of the things that can substantially trim that population tree is a die-off at the top end, which is what this is looking like. And that will have massive economic repercussions. However, those repercussions could end up looking good within the construct of this has been an epic disaster and people dying is bad, but also people are not buying services. They're not going to. When an old person dies, that's still bad for the economy because they're not buying the services that their wealth has purchased over the time, that they've spent that time building up. But if they die with wealth left, it goes to their heirs. If they don't have heirs, then it moves on to the government. The government spends it. Money constantly is flowing. So in this situation, I'm definitely not saying this is anywhere near a good thing, but there is an economic impact of so many old people dying that is potentially healthy for the economy.
I'm so glad you decided to keep talking there because I saw where you were going. I knew where your question was going, and I was thinking in my mind, how am I going to answer this question honestly without sounding like a giant jackass?
By I am a giant jackass.
The older people dying in some ways will quote-unquote fix some of our demographic problems in the sense that
only
Social Security and other of the aging of the population. And thankfully, you went there first. So I don't have to say anything except say, how dare you? How dare you, sir?
And I can say also that it won't actually fix anything in terms of those structural issues unless we get back to increasing the rates. Now, immigration is a big part of that, and increasing our population growth rates on our own is part of that. But we have those have risks too, especially if you say, as many people, especially younger people, those of, say, child raising and bearing ages, say that increasing the population is not good for the planet, so I'm not going to be a part of that.
Do you think that the 8 weeks or so of relative self-quarantine is going to lead to a population boom?
Dead silence as I ponder that one.
Yeah. Think on that.
Do
I need to lay out the reasons why?
I understand exactly why.
Okay.
I am not so naive as to need that.
Okay.
You know. Fair question.
Yeah.
I will say... Oh, God. I want to say no so badly.
Why do you want to...
But the human...
Let me through your thought process. Why do you want to say no?
Because I want to believe that close proximity shouldn't impact that because the person that they're in close proximity with was already there. Yeah. It's not going to matter. But we see plenty of evidence from bad snowstorms.
Mm-hmm.
You're quarantined because of a bad snowstorm.
You got nothing else to do. Have you looked? Xbox Live's occasionally been down.
Yeah, no, it's been pretty bad this weekend.
Yeah.
And we definitely also know that boredom played into a huge role as why those population rates were so high. If they didn't have anything else to do. The sun went down, you couldn't read anymore if you had reading ability in the first place. So what else is left to do except for fucking?
I mean, Disney Plus has moved up Rise of Skywalker and Frozen 2, but there's only so many times you can watch those movies.
That's that. You put on Frozen 2, so the kids who you're stuck home with are given something to do, so you have a few minutes of peace and quiet to do whatever you like, which happens to be...
Whatever you like, huh?
Whatever you got left.
Whatever you got left, huh? All right.
Oh, I'm so glad my wife doesn't listen to these podcasts.
So we know what's going on whenever Frozen 2 is on in the Riley household, huh?
It hasn't been played yet.
Mm. Really?
No, because it just came out today.
Yesterday, I thought. 14th?
It was the 15th that it was released on Disney Plus.
Rise of Skywalker? Are you going to watch Rise of Skywalker?
I've already watched Rise of Skywalker.
I know, but are you going to watch it again?
God, no.
I might watch it again. I feel like I...
Now that you know all the plot details that weren't in the movie? Maybe.
I feel like it. I need to give another chance.
Fair enough. Are you going to watch it? How many times have you watched Episode 8?
Once.
How many times have you, and you've watched episode 9 once?
Yes.
I don't think you can watch episode 9 until you watch episode 8 again. Do it like a double feature. I know. It's a hard ask.
That feels a lot harder to do.
Isn't it fair? You're saying I just need to rewatch it again? Maybe if you rewatch it, you're like, hey, that Casino Planet bit wasn't so bad.
But see, 8 and 9 are so diametrically opposed that it feels like that would just make things worse.
You're watching matter and antimatter interact. It's very entertaining.
Doesn't that kill you?
Only if you're, you know, really close to it. Yeah.
If you're close to watch it, I think it kills you. I mean, I'm no physicist. Much like I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physicist. But I know from Star Trek that matter and antimatter cause explosions. One more thing I wanted to bring up is the Federal Reserve. Talking about, like, nerdy topics
here. We're super nerdy now. But that's okay. We've always been super nerdy, but now we're just bringing you into the super nerdy.
They're taking, I want to say, drastic measures, but... I don't know. They've been making the drastic measures for the past, like, decade and a half, so...
Yeah, it's been... They were trying to return to normalcy, so they took drastic measures in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, which was primarily spurred by bad mortgages, shall we say. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but that's the single-sentence version. And at that time, they took two measures that were really quite substantial. First is that they reduced the interest rates at which the Federal Reserve loaned money to banks to a range from 0% to 0.25%. And that is the lowest that they have ever gone. The second thing that they did was what is something called quantitative easing, where the Federal Reserve took money that they printed and bought U.S. treasuries and mortgage-backed securities from the banks and said, okay, we're going to take this money that we made out of thin air because we're the Federal Reserve and give it to you in exchange for these assets that are not worth a whole lot to help prop the economy up. And that's called quantitative easing, as I said. Those two measures are fundamentally why the economy was able to trundle along even as bad as it was in 2008, because when I reviewed the 2008 crisis, looking into it, it's like, okay, this is looking really bad. I see a bad thing coming. It's going to take, back of the envelope calculation, $2 trillion to fix.
You just made up that number.
No.
You said back of the envelope calculation. You just looked at a blank piece of paper.
From 2008. This was summer or spring of 2008 I was running this calculation. I was like, sure. I told you this story already. That's why I disinvested in 2008, which was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Listen to me, Paul versus the market. Stay invested 100% all the time.
In October,
don't try and time.
In October 2008, I sold all my stocks.
That was a bad idea.
It was a good idea in that I was successfully able to time the market on the downside. I saw the crash coming.
Mm.
Why it was a mistake was I didn't see the rise. I was like, my God, this is really bad. And I stayed out of the market until well after the bottom had passed. When I bought back in, I was able to avoid the downturn, but I had not recouped any of the gain, which mostly made for my brilliant decision-making no change. Mm-hmm. I would have been just as well off for the most part if I had just left it in the market the entire time. So don't try and prime the market. You don't have to be right once. You have to be right twice.
Because even if you're right... Well, yeah, even if you're right twice, you might just break even.
I was only right once,
nah.
And I broke even, nah. Essentially. But you do have to be right the second time. So $2 trillion is what my calculation said. And the reason why I got out of the market was I said, there's no way. There is no way. There is no federal stimulus package that could possibly pass Congress that'll cover a $2 trillion hole in this economy. And I was right. The stimulus package was only $800 billion, which is roughly one-third of what was necessary. the Federal Reserve took care of the rest through this quantitative easing, through the remarkable interest rates. Why we're talking about this now, the Federal Reserve has reissued their rates back to 0 to 1/4%, the lowest they've ever been, the lowest as they were in the downturn of the 2008 financial crisis, and they have also reinstituted quantitative easing. The Federal Reserve sees this as just as much or more of a financial crisis as the financial crisis.
And I feel the need to try and explain that. I don't know how it's... So the Federal Reserve and quantitative easing, it's all a very complicated topic that I'm not going to... It would take hours to explain.
We've got another podcast to go at that point.
Yeah, but I'll try and do my best in like 2 minutes. It's basically a quasi-governmental agency. I refuse to say that the Federal Reserve is independent of the government. It's kind of a quasi-governmental agency, basically throwing tons and tons of money at all the banking institutions saying, please take this money and give it to other people at cheap rates to try and get those people to spend money, to try and get the economy going again. It's a little bit more complicated than that, obviously, but it's basically injecting a ton of monetary supply into the economy to try and jumpstart it.
It is very roughly inflation, attempting to inflate the economy because it is rapidly deflating on its own.
Which is funny because we have seen very little official inflation over the past like 2 decades.
Right. The fact that we have seen so little inflation has come from the fact that they had deflated the economy so badly. The inflation that we saw in the past few years was all actually seen in the run-up to the financial crisis. We inflated horribly at that time, and then we deflated, but we didn't actually see the deflate because the Federal Reserve sort of kept us level through that period, which, to their credit, was probably a whole lot less financially painful for people than if we had deflated. But as a result, we didn't see the inflation that you might have seen because we'd already seen it. The inflation was already baked in. Now we were getting to the point where we're starting to see a little bit of inflation, and here comes a new crisis, and instead of seeing that inflation, we're ready to climb back down the hill, and like, oh no, deflation is worse. We're going to prop up the economy and prevent that from happening.
So why do you think, as our chief cryptocurrency correspondent...
This is new one for me.
Why do you think Bitcoin has collapsed over the past couple of weeks?
All right.
You would think, with all these drastic measures the Federal Reserve has taken, which would seem to be causing rampant inflation amongst the U.S. dollar, that this is Bitcoin's time to shine, right? This was like so many of the arguments for a independent cryptocurrency where the monetary supply was strictly controlled and capped. This should be where it's not going from 10,000 to 5,000, but from like 10,000 to 20,000 to 30,000. Why do you think it's done the opposite?
So it comes down to, first, to reiterate, why should Bitcoin go up?
Mm-hmm.
Is that Bitcoin is an asset class that is disconnected from the stock market and disconnected from currency.
Mm-hmm.
It is a currency, effectively a foreign currency without being a foreign currency, that has its value severed from the rest of that economy. So
it's effectively like gold.
It's effectively like gold. And I haven't looked at gold prices. I should.
I don't think it's acted in the way that one would have thought either. I think it's gone down slightly.
So this comes back to the question, if Bitcoin and gold are both going down, why are they both going down? And the answer is, who owns it?
Mm-hmm.
Who is the investor class that owns gold? Who
is it the 1%?
Partially, yes.
Yeah.
You know, the person who is in that 1% sees the economy going down and sends out a bunch of sell signals across the board, like, oh my God, it's bad. I'm panicking. Don't panic. Sell everything. And when they say sell everything, they sell everything, including the Bitcoin, even though there's no reason why it should go down. There's too much of that concentrated in too few hands for them to not be going down in concert, unless there is something that's wider distributed. The person who has a couple of bucks in Bitcoins doesn't make the market.
So let me ask you a stupid question. If everyone's selling stocks, clearly, because they've been going down,
yep,
and people are selling gold because Let's just say it's gone down or whatever.
I haven't checked it. So you're saying it's going down. I'm taking your word for it right
I'm
now.
I'm
going
to assume it's gone down. But, okay, let's leave gold out of it. But people are selling Bitcoin.
Bitcoin's definitely gone down.
What are people buying? Where's all that money going?
It's going into cash, and that cash is not buying anything. It's being held for the chance to buy toilet paper and hand sanitizer and buy when it's cheaper. You know, the rule about financial panics...
So you're a Keynesian now, huh?
The rules about financial panics are, number one, don't panic.
Okay.
And number two, if you're going to panic, panic before anyone else does.
Yeah. That's why we've got a full closet full of hand sanitizer here. That's not true. We were talking about having a discussion about price gouging. You want to do it? I don't know if we should do it.
We've gone a little long here. Can we do it in like 5 minutes?
I don't know. You're the one that talks a lot. Defend price gouging.
You're the one who defends price gouging. I'm the one who attacks price gouging.
Fine, attack price gouging.
Okay, so price gouging is immoral, obviously.
Okay. Is that it?
That's the start.
Okay. I think that price gouging... Obviously, loaded term, right? And clearly, there are levels of price gouging. There's the asshole who goes and buys everything and then decides to try and sell it for exorbitant amounts.
Calling it market arbitrage.
Regardless of need or anything like that.
Right. He's becoming the new supplier. Because the old supplier wasn't selling for the proper price. The arbitrage prices, people are willing to pay more because this thing is higher value now, because there's more demand for it, and there's less supply for it. That means value goes up. So he's willing to buy it at that lower price that it exists and sell it. He's just doing the market. He's playing the market.
But I think, like I said, I think there's a sliding scale here where there is room for reasonable amounts of what some people might call price gouging, but which I think is just the market working. In that, let's say you have two stores. Store A, which decides to sell hand sanitizer, no one can seem to get anywhere, right?
Or toilet
but
paper.
Or toilet paper. Sure, let's say toilet paper. Store A sells toilet paper for the normal amount, and the first panickers, if you will, come in and say like, "Psh, I'll just buy all this toilet paper because why not? Like, it's the regular price." And then the second panickers come in and there's no toilet paper to buy. You basically only benefit those first people who panicked. If the market is working and prices are responding dynamically, then you can raise those prices 2 times, 3 times, even 4 times, 5 times. And those first panickers come in and be like, "Crap, I'm not going to spend like $50 to buy whatever, 20 rolls of toilet paper. That's just excessive." And they won't buy all the toilet paper. More people get toilet paper.
More accurately, to your point, arguing against perhaps my point, the person who is most in need of toilet paper, and, big caveat here, which is I'm going to come back to it a little bit, the person who has the means to, while having that need, still has toilet paper to buy. It is better for toilet paper to be $20 a roll for the person who has $20 and needs a roll than for toilet paper to not be on the shelf and I have $100 and I can't buy any.
Exactly. And that's the point. That's exactly the point that I made when eBay decided to implement... They shut down any listings for hand sanitizer or toilet paper. I can't remember which one, but one of them.
Anything that's being gouged right now.
Any price gouging prices for hand sanitizer or toilet paper, which you could take whichever side you want on that, but what you're effectively saying is that it's better for somebody who desperately wants hand sanitizer and will pay $50 for hand sanitizer. It's better that they not be able to buy it at all, rather than to have the choice to buy it at $50. Because these are all voluntary transactions, right? Nobody's being forced to buy hand sanitizer for $50.
The reason why it's not a voluntary transaction is that the person who needs the hand sanitizer, which is why I prefer the toilet paper answer, because toilet paper is more of a need than a hand sanitizer situation. The person who needs that roll of toilet paper, because they don't have any toilet paper, and they got kids at home with poopy butts, they need that toilet paper, and they don't have the $20 for the roll of toilet paper. The market has not served them because the demand did not meet them. The supply, sorry, did not meet their demand.
Right.
And that is also a market failure.
Sure, but the supply will never meet that demand as long as you make rules saying that you can only sell toilet paper for 25 cents a roll.
I don't want to go down that path too far, mm-hmm. because that's a different part of market manipulation than what we're talking about right now. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is price gouging. Sure. Price gouging is bad in that the person who is charging more because they have that supply of a thing that is in limited demand is not distributing it according to true need. They're mm-hmm. distributing it according to need and ability to buy. And that is not something that is universal.
I don't disagree, but at the same time, laws against price gouging basically say, instead of you being, it basically takes away your choice. It doesn't.
This is where, as a libertarian, I'm mostly going to be in agreement with you, right. but I have to attack it in that there are market failures on both sides, and mm-hmm. you're coming down on the side of one market failure when the people on the other side are coming down the market failure on the other side, saying it's better that we be in this situation than that situation, and I'm not 100% sure which one is correct. They're both failures. Markets are failing when it comes to this kind of situation. And if markets can fail, as they do, we know they do, then that should give you cause for concern and a moment of pause each time the markets can fail and say, okay, is the market really the best solution for this mechanism?
And to be clear, this isn't as much of a defense against price gouging as much as I may have said that earlier. It's more of the rules against price gouging make no sense to me. Because in this specific case with eBay, you're basically saying that instead of some people being able to voluntarily pay $50 for hand sanitizer, nobody can get hand sanitizer. And that just seems overall to be worse for everybody.
If that were actually true, and this is a point that we had the discussion on different forums, but the end result was it's not a single market. eBay is not the only place where you can buy these things. If you do, in fact, sure. say, nowhere across the entirety of the market, and including black markets, which is the biggest issue we're going to have to talk about this here, nowhere across any of these markets is anyone allowed to sell this product because price gouging exists with this product right now, then that's really bad for everyone. But the problem with that idea in its basic formulation is that you cannot stop black markets. Right. What it does is it limits the ability of situations like this to occur where it prevents the ease. Let me take a real concrete example that's completely different. We're going to take it away from the market for just a second.
All right.
But still on the laws. I recently read a fun news article about a man who was in prison for life.
This is a fun news article?
It's a fun news article.
Okay.
He's in prison for
bad
life.
Bad start.
For bad things he's done. Specifics okay. escape me at the moment. He was in a position where he was essentially removed from his solitary confinement for the violent crimes he committed. And he's like, guys, parole officer, this is a bad idea. Leave me alone in solitary confinement. And they put him back into the general jail anyway. And then when he's in general jail, he happens to be right next to one of the child molesters that this prison was housing.
Okay.
So guess what happened?
This is the fun story.
This is the fun story.
Okay.
He murders the child molester. And then
I guess that's fun?
He's walking on his way to the warden and say, hey guys, I just murdered a guy in the prison. Put me back in the solitary confinement, like I said. And he comes across a second guy who was a child molester. He's like, well, let's do it again. And he kills another one.
Well,
this jail okay. was clearly negligent.
He killed somebody, and then on his way to report himself, he killed another person?
He wanted to be back in solitary confinement.
Okay.
So he's killed two people.
Sure.
Both of them happen to be child molesters.
At least, presumably.
Well, yeah, there was also the other one that was actually in jail for the first time. But like I said, that's not the story here. Okay. The story is, this gets out into the news. Oh my god, this prisoner has killed two people. But by the way, they're child molesters. And as this story gets out, people are reading this and saying, yeah, fuck those child molesters. Kill them.
Yeah.
And they're sending him large amounts of money to his commissary account for killing people. Okay. Effectively retrograding themselves to hitmen.
Okay.
And the police, the prison system is like, this is not okay. And they shut down his commissary account from receiving money from the outside.
Okay.
Normally, this would be a travesty of justice. The man is not being given his right to the commissary.
I feel like there's a number of travesties of justice going on here, but sure.
We're starting with murder.
Yeah. I mean, just go on. I'll wait for your point.
The point is, in this case, by short-circuiting the efficiency of the problem. They actually stop the problem. People are still capable of giving him money, but they have to go out of their way. They have to look up his name and have to go and write a check and send that check in the mail or to his lawyer, and it'll get to him and he'll have that money. If they really want to be, go you for being a child molesting, murdering bastard, they can still do that. They just limit the ease. eBay is a system that makes transactions really, really easy. Black market transactions, or the guy on the street corner has the hand sanitizer or the toilet paper, and I'm going to take my $20 in cash to him, that's inconvenient. But if I really need it, maybe I can make that happen. eBay facilitates with ease, and because that ease exists, there is a benefit in restricting that kind of position, because the ease of the transaction makes the price gouging much more rampant.
Drink. So, to be clear, you, as a self-described libertarian, are suggesting that...
No, I said I have libertarian tendencies, just to clarify. Okay. Here.
As somebody with libertarian tendencies, is suggesting that we should take voluntary transactions and move them to black market because it's better.
No. I'm saying that black markets are voluntary transactions, and that there are times when I can see, as a rational person, that efficiencies of markets are harmful. That the market has a failure, and that the efficiency of the market actually exacerbates the problem rather than correcting it. And that markets, I'm not an anarcho-capitalist, I'm a libertarian-esque.
I thought you had tendencies.
I'm libertarian-esque.
I literally just called you libertarian.
Yes, and I clarified me. So I'm clarifying it again.
All right.
I am definitely not an anarcho-capitalist.
Okay.
That point that you're making is an anarcho-capitalist point. Hmm. It is not necessarily a strict libertarian point. There's the voluntarianism and the libertarian, but it's the capitalist side of things. I'm not 100% sold on the capitalism.
I'm not going to go and describe all those terms you just said. I'm just going to...
Words, words, words.
I'm going to explain the main takeaway is that you're comparing people who hoard toilet paper to child molesters, or to the people who kill child molesters. I'm not entirely clear. But you're definitely doing that comparison to one of them.
I'm just going to go with it. Let's go with that. That's sure. Definitely 100% accurate to what I said.
So how low do you think the 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate is going to get?
Absolute bottom. I definitely don't see it going below 1.5. I think 2.5 is its bottom.
Do you think we're going to get a negative?
Unless it goes negative. If the Federal Reserve Board say 2 months, I don't think they go negative quickly. I think they hold on this for a really long time if they possibly can. I think it's going to take 2 months. If things are really bad still in 2 months and they're saying we need to push this some more, I think they could go negative, and I think that would be disastrous for the economy. If that happens, all bets are off.
So as somebody who was advocating to be the first to panic.
Yeah. It's too late, by the way.
What should we hoard now? Gold, Bitcoin, ammunition, canned goods, or something else?
Of those, definitely ammunition and canned goods.
Okay.
And the next one to consider would be something like bolt cutters.
Bolt cutters.
Yeah.
So you can steal from other people.
Bingo.
Okay. We've learned a lot about you tonight.
You're asking about survivalism, okay? You know, I'm not saying it's a good thing. Make sure you steal from the right people.
Not those on the left, but those on the right.
Ideally, those that don't have guns.
Who are the right people?
The people who don't have guns.
Okay. That's
because they're going to shoot you if you try and steal from them.
All right. Anything else we should touch upon? Any other advice we should give other than wash your hands and don't touch your face? Hand sanitizer.
Don't panic.
Don't. I'm not sure that's good advice. Don't we want a little bit of panic?
I don't. You want to be concerned. You want to be aware. But you don't want to panic, because panic means that you are not thinking rationally.
Hmm.
Think rationally. Understand there are serious risks at hand. This is how it can play out. This is how it's going to go bad. Know what the worst case scenario is. And then say, how do I deal with that? Mental resilience means anti-fragility, something we've spoken about recently, means understanding that the risks are there and can come, and that you can handle the worst case scenario. And that if you can't handle that worst case scenario, you make whatever adjustments to your life that you need to remove that worst case scenario from the table. And if you can't do that, then find someone who can help you do that.
Preferably someone with a gun.
Yeah. All right.
All right. I think that's a good place to end this on. So from both of us here, stay safe out there. Wash your hands. Listen to the experts, notably not us. And can't stop the discourse.